Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
And Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and today we are going to number 48 on our favorite 100 movies of all time, and we are doing the long-awaited Shakespeare in Love versus American History X episode, which I feel like I have to put the word verse in there, because if you say that Shakespeare in Love is a good movie, immediately people feel like they are in a fight with you and you are attacking them and you're being antagonistic and all of that fun stuff. But at the end of the day, I just love Shakespeare in Love, and I just want to give it its due course, because it has been shit on over time for really no reason. But American History X, a much more popular movie from that time, that I will still say at this moment, I think is incredibly overrated, and I can't wait to talk with John about it. We gave it the same amount of stars. I actually gave American History X 3 stars and then went back and lowered it because I was actually kind of frustrated. And I have so much to say about American History X versus Crash tonight that I just can't wait to get going right here. But both of us coming in number 48. I love that these movies are both from 1998. Two very polarizing movies. One just hated on because it won Best Picture. One that really gained some acclaim because of Edward Norton's performance, but also didn't necessarily hit that same level with critics, despite the fact that Norton's performance did. This should be a fun one, John. Welcome to 1998. I hope you feel cool as a six-year-old again.
I absolutely do. 1998, what a weird year. I remember watching Shakespeare in Love the year it came out, which kind of baffled me when I rewatched it. It's like, how did I watch this movie?
There's some boobs in this movie, John.
Years old. Yeah, that's what I was. That's what I said. I was like, oh, there are boobs in this movie. I don't remember.
Even as a Canadian. Yeah, even as a Canadian, like at 6, 7 years old, maybe not the best content.
But it was really refreshing going back to Shakespeare in Love after all these years and having actually like studied Shakespeare a bit in university and just having a love for Shakespeare itself. So going back and revisiting it was really interesting this week.
Yeah, we're going to start with this one. We're starting with Shakespeare in Love because American History X is the more popular movie. And I just can't wait to talk about Shakespeare in Love. I have always loved this movie. So it's funny because I'm not somebody who will just be like, oh, you said that movie stinks. Now I must love it. But American Beauty was a movie that my dad always talked about as being overrated and not very good and whatever. And I sat down and watched that as like a 15-year-old and was like, holy shit, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And it wasn't just to spite my father. But this was another movie where everybody always gave it a hard time. Every list that ever came out, this was always at the top of it of Oscar Best Picture winners that should have never won. It was always just beat to a pulp by the public. And I sat down and I watched it and I said, what the hell did I miss? And every time that I've watched it since, which I have seen this movie a lot, I'm talking a lot, I just find it to be so much fun. If there's one thing that Shakespeare tends to not be for the majority of people in 2022, it is fun. There are huge Shakespeare fans, and there's no denying that. There are people who study Shakespeare and are really into it and will defend him till the day they die. But for the most part, if you go watch Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, good luck trying to keep your eyes open while you're watching that. And that happens a lot. How many times can we see Romeo and Juliet done? But what I love about Shakespeare in Love is that it plays on all of the tropes of Shakespeare. It plays on all of the tropes of plays. There is so much overacting in this movie, but purposefully. And it leans into all of it so hard that you're sitting there wondering what kind of fantasy world was William Shakespeare actually living in when he was writing all of these things. It makes 1593 seem like a really good time to be alive, even though there's a plague going on, people are dropping dead from being stabbed or whatever it is. Nobody's allowed to have plays. The royalty is making sure that the peasants can't eat and, you know, can't do anything. But it's making it seem like it's a very fun and interesting time to be alive. I love the world that is built here. I just love it. And I think that the story is very fun. It's fast paced. It's a take on Romeo and Juliet, but in a different way. And I just think that this screenplay is full of wit and super entertaining, and that people just totally miss the point of what this movie was supposed to be.
Yeah, I can agree with that, because I think a lot of people kind of see this movie as just like, you know, your typical like mid to late 90s rom-com. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely not what this movie is. And I think this movie really pays off more for people who are well-versed in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I can see how that could be polarizing, especially back in 98 when people like were watching this movie. Because quite frankly, no one really knows this movie exists anymore.
Only that it stinks.
Yeah.
Like all and the like, only time, this is the time of year, and I love that we're doing this in the middle of February, because this is the only time of year that Shakespeare in Love comes up. It's kind of like, I don't know how much you paid attention to with the American election, but they were doing all these things about like Black Lives Matter. When does it spike? It's always during election year that it's like the searches for Black Lives Matter pops up more. It happened in 2016. It happened in 2020. Shakespeare in Love is like that, but with only at Oscar season. Every February, like clockwork, this movie rears its head just to be shit on by somebody. That's all it is. But people don't watch this movie. That's the thing that gets me. The number of people who say this movie stinks and should have never won Best Picture compared to the number of people who have actually seen the movie, it's interesting how so many more people know it's bad even though they've never sat down and watched it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I have my gripes with some things that happen in the movie, but overall, like, it's a very enjoyable movie that, like I said, it really has its payoffs for those who are very knowledgeable about Shakespeare. Because I sat there just kind of like, looking at all of these different Shakespeare Easter eggs throughout. It's like, oh, that's cool, Nod. Some of them were a little heavy-handed, and some of them were a little, like, ridiculous. Mostly towards the beginning of the film, I found that happen with, like, the one gentleman of Verona and stuff like that. I was like, okay, I get it. You're making a joke based on the title of a Shakespeare play saying, oh, this isn't his actual play. But, like, that type of humor didn't really hit me. Whereas it's like when you look at some of the other references that are made in this movie, something like the Juliet costume being the Zeffirelli costume, like that resonated a lot more with me and made the movie more enjoyable for me.
Yeah, and I think, see, that's what I like so much about this movie, though, and it did rightfully win Best Screenplay that year. Mm-hmm. I think it was original, right? Or was it adapted? I forget exactly which category
it won. I believe it's original.
I believe, but either way, I love the screenplay in this because it is, there are so many winks and nods. You were talking about the pirate thing. A lot of people might sit there and go, oh, the Ethel, the pirate's daughter or something like that. They don't realize necessarily that this was the Deus Ex Machina for Hamlet. Shakespeare, for Hamlet. Exactly.
Yeah, for Hamlet. It's like, they're pirates. That makes it so that Hamlet's back in Denmark. And like, yeah, I really love that joke. I'm like, okay, why are they doing this pirate thing? And then when I finally caught on to this, like, okay, that's actually really funny.
Yes, exactly. And so I love that kind of stuff. I think that this movie really leans in with a heavy hand of like, all of his inspiration was coming from this one muse and his interactions with this one muse. It is very much a romantic comedy. Like it is, it does follow a lot of the standards of a lot of really basic romantic comedies. However, it's not a basic romantic comedy. Like it is elevating it because of the world that it's living in, because of the dialogue that it's having, because of the characters, and because it's somebody so well known that I would actually say that I would bet most Shakespeare fans probably actually quite enjoy this movie. They might not love it, but they probably enjoy this movie. It's really the people who aren't Shakespeare fans that it seems like hate this more. And again, I just go back to, I think this movie just gets a bad rap, and I could bet you, anytime you see an article from like Collider or Slant or whatever else, it's probably being written by somebody who hasn't seen this movie. Like it really is probably because this is not also an easy movie to find. American History X, a much easier movie to find than Shakespeare in Love all these years later.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the other things to consider when we're talking about like the typical like romantic comedy aspect of it, Shakespeare wrote the book on romantic comedies.
He did.
Like the reason why this comes off as a typical romantic comedy is because Shakespeare's the guy who popularized that genre.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what the point of this movie is. He's got to impress Queen Elizabeth to say love can fit into a play. You can write love. He has, though. Like Romeo and Juliet is the most timeless love story ever.
Yep.
And so because of that, like, you might sit there and say, oh, this is corny. This is frustrating. I hate it. But it is like, yes, it's a very basic way of stating it. But it literally, if you think about it, that is what Shakespeare did. He impressed kings and peasants alike and was able to convince them that he could tell you a love story or tell you a tragedy, all of this stuff. And so I think that like all of these little things that most people will point out as corny, we haven't even gotten into Gwyneth Paltrow yet because I have so much to say about young Gwyneth here, but there's so many things in this movie that I feel like are just misrepresented now that we're 25 years away from when it was released. People kind of miss like, no, the writer of this, which what was his name? You said he did Guildenstern and Rosencrantz Are Dead. I forget what his name is.
Oh, I can't remember his name. Let me check.
It's okay. But he writes this script. He's not trying to make some profound statement about love and all that. He's trying to make a profound statement about Shakespeare and his ability as a writer and how amazing this period was. And so that's where I just totally buy in. I love it. I know, John, you had a note here, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but you had a note from the beginning that said, what is this opening sequence? I think this opening sequence is so funny because it's just leading us in with the stupid thing with the rose and look how pretty it is and everything. And oh, what a wonderful time to be alive. And then it just zooms across and there's Geoffrey Rush looking absolutely haggard and disgusting with his feet on fire over coals and he's being tortured. I just think it's such a funny way because when we think about the Shakespeare times, oh, Romeo and Juliet, like, oh, it must have been so great to have been alive. No, people were like literally like living with rats and just being tortured whenever because there was no way to stop them. I love that contrast to immediately set the stage for what this is.
Yeah, it really helps to kind of break the illusion of, like, that time period in, like, early 17th century, late 16th century, where a lot of people associate that with, like, the Italian Renaissance, where, like, mm-hmm. in England, we're at the very tail end of the Middle Ages still. Like, we're not at the Renaissance part yet. And the opening sequence and, like, having that scene of Jeffrey Rush with his feet over the fire, it kind of ruined that.
And I think Jeffrey Rush is very, very good in this movie, too. I think he was nominated for this and didn't win it. And, John, we actually talked about this. But if he had won the Oscar, this would be the most decorated acting film of all time, or tied for the most decorated, because they would have won three of the four major categories. But yeah, I think Jeffrey Rush was the perfect person for this kind of role, because he is a very good actor and he can be very like charismatic and stuff, but he can also play like pretty despicable and grimy and all that. I mean, we see him play one of the great like action adventure villains in Pirates of the Caribbean. So yeah, there's a lot, like he was perfect for this, but yeah, I love this, like, oh, and now it's completely dropped the other foot. I think that's just a great move.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this movie could have benefited, like, Ralph Fiennes. This is that weird period in time where Ralph Fiennes existed in film.
Joe Fiennes.
There was like, or Joe, yeah, this is Joe Fiennes.
Ray Fiennes. Ray Fiennes.
Ray Fiennes is in the other one. Yes. Yeah. But where Joseph Fiennes is in these films just for like this span of like 3 or 4 years and then kind of drops off the face of the earth. And he plays Shakespeare in such a, it's almost a whimsical way where he's so infatuated. He gets the Romeo treatment in this. Like, we see Romeo in Shakespeare, which is great. And like, there are little throwaways too, which I really like. I really like the conversation with Marlowe. When Marlowe kind of like starts going through the plot and like writing Romeo and Juliet with Shakespeare as like the nod to like the one historical theory that Shakespeare was not a single person, because there's no way he could have written all of these plays. So it's like, again, it's these little details in this movie that make it quite enjoyable.
Yeah. And I love the Kit Marlowe thing. I love the John Webster thing and how John Webster is also based on a real person. And like, yeah, there's always, what was that movie that I really didn't like? I think it was Roland Emmerich, Unwritten or something like that, about Anonymous. That was it. Sorry. I was thinking, Natasha Bedingfield, I guess. No, it wasn't Kenneth Branagh, but it had like that kind of feel, but it was just like a very like, what if he never existed? And it's such like a lazy version of this story, but it does put that into people's minds of like, was he real? Was he not real? We don't know. And that's the thing. We really will never know if Shakespeare wrote all of these things or if it was a collective and all that, but Kit Marlowe being able to come in and, you know, it's giving credence to so many of the theories that are out there and everything like that. And again, that's just why I think this is fun. When you grow up and you're stuck reading Romeo and Juliet, for the most part, you hate doing it. It feels like it's in a different language. It can be a bit of a slog. It's tough. But as you get older, you start to appreciate it more. And this movie for me just felt like, ah, all of that stuff that I learned and I don't understand why I learned it, this movie is paying it all off. It's digging into all of that stuff. And I think it does a really fascinating, interesting job of capturing it.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point about like the modern look at Shakespeare, where a lot of people kind of view it as this chore and in high school when you're like reading Shakespeare and stuff. But like when I was teaching, I taught Shakespeare and I saw a breakthrough in kids because they understood Shakespeare. And like that's where Shakespeare comes in. It's just this these timeless tales that Shakespeare has. And when we get these adaptations of Shakespeare where this isn't a historically accurate story by any means, but the fact that it is just, it's the beginnings of like, it's parts of Romeo and Juliet mixed with parts of the Twelfth Night. And it's really, which
the Twelfth Night is the play they tell in the right. She tells him, Judi Dench tells him the right that.
Yeah.
The Twelfth Night.
So it's really clever. And it has this ability to transcend age. That's the beauty of Shakespeare. Shakespeare doesn't just stay in the 16th century and 17th century when it was first written. It transcends time, and people of all ages get to enjoy it. And that's really what this movie is trying to push forward, is that, yes, these are typical tropes we're seeing in the 90s, but they transcend time because they're Shakespearean.
Yeah. And I will say, I think most people love the idea of Shakespeare. They just don't like the execution of Shakespeare nowadays. I think most people love the idea of, like, the Hamlet story is a pretty friggin' epic story. But then when the execution, you're like, like, this is a drag. Romeo and Juliet. There's a reason why there's been 900 versions of Romeo and Juliet, whether it's Romeo and Juliet or West Side Story, which was just remade. Mm-hmm. It's the same exact thing. And so... Yeah. Like, but this whole idea that, like, it was because he was in this long lost lover thing and all of that, it's like, it is what it is. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I just buy into it. And I think you can go one of two ways with this. You can either buy into it or you cannot buy into it at all. For me, I buy into what's going on with this story. I think it's fun. I think it's a quippy little tale on this. And now I have to get to Gwyneth Paltrow. Joseph Fiennes wasn't nominated for this movie. Judi Dench rightfully won her Oscar, even though she's in like 6 minutes of the movie. She's freaking awesome in this movie.
Well,
like, she is.
This year has definitely proven that Judi Dench can get nominated for movies she's only in for 6 minutes.
Yeah, Belfast also did the same thing. And I will tell you that Belfast, she's pretty much just playing Judi Dench. This, she is playing Queen Elizabeth, and she's freaking epic. Jeffrey Rush was nominated, doesn't win. I haven't seen the person who did win that year. I forget who it is, but I haven't seen the movie yet. However, Gwyneth Paltrow is consistently badgered for winning this Oscar this year. Always. Just hated on for winning this Oscar. I recently watched Elizabeth, which is what everybody says should have won. Cate Blanchett should have won for Elizabeth. I recently watched Elizabeth. I think Elizabeth is a good movie, like a very good movie. I think I gave it 3.5 stars. I really enjoyed it. Cate Blanchett's performance in that movie is good, but it is so freaking overrated. It's insane. It's not this like, oh my God, you'll never believe what you just watched. Maybe at the time it was, but it certainly doesn't feel that way anymore. I love what Gwyneth Paltrow is able to do in this movie because she's leaning in to the tone of this movie. A lot of reviewers, a lot of people say that she shouldn't have won the Oscar because all she does is dress up as a boy and she's not even convincing of that. She's not supposed to be convincing as a boy. That is the point of the movie, is how ridiculous it is that back in that time, men were on stage dressing up as women. And as long as they talked in a high-pitched voice, they were women. If women went on the stage, you were shut down, as we see happen in this movie. That's the ridiculousness of it. It's a trope in Shakespeare stuff for people to just dress up. Joseph Fiennes at one point in this movie is pretending he's a woman and everybody just buys into it because it's leaning into how ridiculous it is that we would assume people were just so stupid that, yep, that's a woman. That's a woman. Whatever. Like, it's so dumb, but I love it. And there's even scenes in this where the part where they're on the boat going across and he says, all right, have a good day, madam, or whatever he calls her. And she goes, madam. And she goes, oh yeah, that's Viola de Lesseps. And he can't believe it, but it's so obvious. It's like, duh, no, duh, that's Viola. She is not supposed to be convincing. She is supposed to just be playing the role that is presented to her. And that is the whole Shakespeare thing, right? The world's a stage and everyone's a player. She's a player on this stage of reality for William Shakespeare. And so I think that this performance is really awesome. I think she's very good in this movie. I think she's totally believable in what she's supposed to be doing. And I love watching her interactions with Joseph Fiennes. She owns this. I still think Joseph Fiennes should be nominated for this. I think it's a very good performance that he just doesn't get that much credit for because he was seen as like the pretty boy. But I really, really love Gwyneth Paltrow's role. I love the way she does it. I love that she does have the whole Juliet thing going on of, oh, love and everything. And she's just like flailing about. I think it's great. I think it's a great performance. And I think it's super underrated because people just miss what it's supposed to be, what it's supposed to be saying, and would rather just be angry at it. Are you there? I fear that John may have frozen. So I'm just going to keep talking. I hear him moving.
I don't know.
I'm hearing you moving. Hello. John. All right. I'll just keep talking until he comes back. You might have to leave and come back or something. I don't know.
No, it's okay. I'm here.
Okay, you're here.
No, I'm here.
What's up? Welcome back.
I don't know what that was, but... Yeah, I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow's performance, like you said, she's not supposed to be believable as a boy in this movie, because that is the Shakespearean trope. It's the fact that Shakespeare wrote these women dressing as men to get to infiltrate different circles and everything. It's called dramatic irony, people. The audience, obviously know she's a woman. It's funny because the characters don't.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, how could they be so shocked? Like, there's nothing really about her that seems very mannish or boyish. But at the same time, you don't know. I mean, there's plenty of like, I mean, they were picking who plays the women based on who was the least manly. Hang on one sec. My dog is going absolutely crazy. So I'm going to mute this.
Yeah, exactly. They're picking back in those times, back in the late 16th, early 17th century. Men played all of the roles on stage. So the people who would play the woman roles were the ones who hadn't hit puberty or still had full control of their falsetto. And it's even a plot point in the film when we get to the end of it. And all of a sudden, Juliet's voice can't go high anymore. And it gives us that, like, I mean, that kind of a bit of a plot point to make it so that Gwyneth Paltrow's character gets to perform in the play still. But it's the trope and it's the time. And again, these are the little things, the historical accuracies of this film that don't get noted because so many people focus on the historical inaccuracies of this film. You're still muted.
Yep. I'm just nodding along. I know I'm still muted now. My dog was going absolutely crazy. I don't know why the dog was going so bonkers there. But yeah, so that's one big thing. I do think like Ben Affleck, Colin Firth, Tom Wilkinson, this has a very, very good cast of supporting characters. Tom Wilkinson, really one of the first movies. Tom Wilkinson was in The Full Monty the year before, but Tom Wilkinson wasn't really getting like these big, big roles yet. So it was him kind of still coming into his own, even though he's an older actor, but he was a Shakespeare guy. And then Ben Affleck is great in this. I think he is so funny as Ned. I love the part where it's like, I have this role in Mercutio, blah, blah, blah. He goes, what's the name of the play? Mercutio. And everybody, it's like, it's just that type of stuff, like leaning into these are other things. Like writer jokes in this movie are top notch.
Yeah.
The part about, well, we pay them nothing and we give them a portion of the profits, but there's never profits. Exactly. Like that type of stuff is just great because that is what they do in Hollywood. So
yeah, exactly. Like there are a lot of well thought out jokes in this. And while I personally don't think this is Tom Stoppard's best adaptation for his written work when it comes to Shakespeare, because I do think Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead is
Tom Stoppard. That's right. I can remember.
His name. I got that. I do think it's a lot more clever than this, but it's trying to be a lot more clever and a lot wittier than this is. Whereas this is still a Hollywood movie trying and not a stage play. So it makes sense. But yeah, the one thing that really bugged me about this. Okay, it's actually two. The introduction of Colin Firth and Gwyneth Paltrow's characters, just like as audience members of this play, seemed really weird.
Say that one more time. Sorry.
So,
What do you mean? Like them just being there?
It's like, hey, these are two people in the audience. Now we're focusing on them. It felt like a weird transition in the story to me. Whereas if we didn't see them in the audience and it just transitioned, I think it would have felt smoother to me.
See, I like the whole thing of like Gwyneth Paltrow is already so obsessed with like this whole like hopeless romantic thing.
Yeah.
Of like in love with the writer and all these words and poetry and all that. Cause it leans into like, why would this character be so invested in this?
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I get that. And I get how it's important for a character. It's really Colin Firth's character that really feels.
Yeah. Colin Firth does kind of come in a weird time, in a weird place.
Yeah. But Colin Firth also has one of the best Shakespeare callbacks when they're at, the funeral, mm-hmm. or like they're praying for Marlowe, and he just like starts reciting Macbeth when Shakespeare walks in. Mm-hmm. That's one of the most beautiful callbacks in this entire film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's those little things, though. Like, again, like, this is why this movie wins screenplay. Like, mm-hmm. I know this was the year that Saving Private Ryan came out, and pretty much everybody thought Saving Private Ryan should have won Best Picture. Now, I know you and I both aren't very big fans of Saving Private Ryan. I call Saving Private Ryan, like, a 2.5, 3-star movie. I don't hate it, but it's okay. The screenplay for Saving Private Ryan just isn't very good. And that's something that really bothers people. Why are these 8 people going to save the life of one? And how ridiculous is the plot of this movie? Like, the movie yeah. is ridiculous. The dialogue is pure corn. But that's like the thing. It depends on what are you looking for in a movie.
Yeah.
A war movie doesn't need to necessarily have great dialogue and things like that. The whole opening with Normandy is great. But like you said, why does it have the corny bookend? Why does it have to have him walking out to the cemetery? Why does it need that? It doesn't need that. It's to try to pull at your heartstrings, and it's cheap. It's cheap as anything. But what are you looking for in a movie? If you sit down and watch Shakespeare in Love and you're looking for severe racism and a look at racism in America, you're probably going to be disappointed. You should probably watch American History X. If you sit down and you watch, Saving Private Ryan, and you're looking for a comedy about Shakespeare, you're probably watching the wrong movie. And I think that that's just where this Shakespeare in Love thing comes in. It's a lot of people who are not sitting down to enjoy a movie about Shakespeare yes. and about how he is going through the same thing that every other struggling writer goes through. Everybody who loves Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, that movie probably doesn't exist if Shakespeare in Love doesn't happen.
Yep.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is like the same thing. It's just, obviously, it's a brilliant screenplay and it has all that crazy stuff going on, but it's about a guy who, it's Charlie Kaufman. Like, it is yep. Charlie Kaufman telling his own story, pretending he's Joel Barish, and he is going about telling you his inner thoughts and trying to fall in love with somebody who's different, who he doesn't feel like he can obtain. Like, all of these romantic comedies, they all follow a similar thing. And we see this all the time from the point of view of writers. This one just happens to be with one of the famous, with the most famous writer of all time.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it loses some people and frustrates some people. But I love this. I really thought that this was going to be the time where I was going to sit down and watch it and be like, you know what? I've overrated it my whole life. Now I got to go defend this and feel like an ass about it. I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie.
I think what it comes down to is 98 was a really weird year when it came to the Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. We had 3 World War II movies.
Yes.
And 2 Elizabethan dramas.
Yep.
And these other 4 movies nominated for Best Picture were all very realistic depictions of historical events. And this one took its liberty with historical fallacy. And that is where people have a problem with it.
Which
and
is that, funny, and though.
It's in context, people are just, it's hard to compare Shakespeare in Love to these other 4 movies because of how drastically different it is than those 4 movies.
But you're going to tell me that Saving Private Ryan isn't a historically inaccurate movie?
No, I'm not going to tell you that.
That's what I'm saying, though.
I'll say that the Normandy landing is a historically accurate depiction of the Normandy landing. But, yeah. I mean, that's one sequence in the film. But, like, that, I'm saying that that is what the viewpoint of people in 1998 mm-hmm. was. Is that these movies are all very serious movies, except for Shakespeare in Love. And sometimes people just can't respect a movie that is funny and witty when compared to something serious.
Yeah. Well, and that's why comedies never win Oscars. They almost yes. never win Best Picture. You know, I mean, I always consider American Beauty a comedy, but that was a drama. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it, how does it end? Does it end tragically or does it end comically? That's what Shakespeare's whole thing was. If it ends tragically, then it's a tragedy. If it ends comically, then it's a comedy. And this will be the last thing. So we're going to wrap this up and get to American History X, because we also got to talk about The Power of the Dog tonight. But I love the ending of this. I love him writing her story for her, but yeah. also, is this really where she's going, or is this just what he's hoping and imagining and all of that? The line of you'll never age for me, nor fade, nor die is just, to me, that's just perfection. That is just one of those lines that is just like, wow, that's how you end a relationship in a romantic comedy, especially when you really think about what that means. It's so truthful yeah. because this is his muse and this is everybody he's going to write every time, and she will always be that. Yeah. I love it. I think the ending is great. It's powerful. Her walking on the beach with the credits rolling and like this dominance of now she's going to conquer Virginia.
Yep.
It's brilliant. I have chills thinking about it. I'm not even kidding. Like, I have chills thinking about that. I love this movie. I think it is criminally underrated. I think people got to give it a little bit more love, and I think it deserves that love, and stop buying into just the hate, because that is what has happened to this movie, and it does not deserve it in any way, shape, or form. This, and John, I know you only gave it 2.5 stars, but this is still a movie with so much artistic merit that people just completely miss. They just completely miss it, or they just don't take the time to act. A lot of people go into this movie already saying, I hate this movie. It's a terrible way to go to a movie. It's a because you're never going to enjoy something if you already hate it.
Mm-hmm. What I really appreciate about this movie is that it really got me into a Shakespeare kick. I watched 2 other Shakespeare movies that day that I watched this movie because I was just like, I love Shakespeare. I'm going to keep going.
Yep. Yeah. So there you go. Enjoyable. Let's move on, though, to the best thing you watched this week. And before we do that, I just want to say, if you're a $5 patron over at patreon.com/survivorspecialist, and you can weed through all of the Survivor content there, John and I are doing all of our retro on all of our a recap, a review, whatever you want to call it, on all 10 of the Best Picture nominees. We did one for Licorice Pizza last week. It's up there. If you become a $5 patron, you'll have access to that. And tonight we're going to record The Power of the Dog. We're going to start recording these a little bit quicker than just one a week, but this week that's just what it's going to be. But it's The Power of the Dog that we're going to be talking about tonight. So if you have any interest in listening to like a half-hour deep dive into the Best Picture nominees for each one, go ahead, check that out. And those are up on the Patreon. But John, what was the best thing you watched this week?
It was, in fact, one of the Best Picture nominees because, oh my God, Drive My Car is an incredible film.
I got that, it. Yeah, that's coming out on HBO Max March 2nd here in the States.
It absolutely blew my mind. It's slow and lingering. I mean, you know me, I love my slow cinema. Mm-hmm. The fact that the opening credits to the film don't start until 40 minutes into the movie.
Ooh.
It's so beautiful. It's such a touching story of like just self-reflection and learning. It had my attention the entire time. It is a movie that will most likely end up on my next iteration of my top 100.
I love that. All right. Well, there you go. I had an interesting week. I watched 2 of the Best Picture nominees and a Best Picture nominee from way, way, way back, Roman Polanski movie I'd never seen called Tess. Every single one of them got 3 stars. So trying to pick what my favorite out of all of them was is tough. I'm actually going to go with Nightmare Alley though. Nightmare Alley, I thought had a really cool look to it. And man, I love the ending of this movie. I knew it was going there the whole time, but I thought it was so good. My biggest problem with Nightmare Alley is that the beginning is about half hour too long, especially since the Carney stuff doesn't come back. To spend a whole hour with the Carney stuff and then not have it be another, I understand that it shaped everything, but cut it to a half hour, make the movie 2 hours long. This is a 4-star movie and I'm sitting down talking about it like it is the next coming. Belfast, I saw it. I liked it. I didn't love it. I feel like the more I watch that movie, the more I'm going to love it. But right now it's a like, not a love. Tess was also very good, though, just insanely long. Roman Polanski, keep your movies to 2 hours and 10 minutes. That's what you're good at. All right, John, let's talk about the number one on AFI's top 100 heroes. Let's talk about American History X.
Yeah, definitely a massive hero here. American History X is one of those interesting movies where it's a tough watch. There are very tough moments in this movie to watch. The curb stomp scene is honestly one of the most disturbing scenes ever put to film.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll find anyone who really disagrees with that. But taking it in its time, where it's really looking in on like race relations in LA and America in the 90s is really interesting. But I would like to argue that this movie is much more relevant today than it was in 1998. Not because of its investigation into race relationships, but rather its investigation into propaganda and extremism.
Well, and I think what I found funny about watching this movie this time, this is the second time I've watched this movie. The first time I watched it, I was like 16, 17, whatever that age range was, where every teenage boy is like, this is the coolest movie ever. You got to see this. Yeah. And I watched it. I didn't really like it. And this time I watched it and I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. I thought it was okay. I think I gave it 2.5. Like I said, I had it at 3 and then I was like, ooh. What I found interesting about this, though, is that this movie proves that 2016, 17, 18, 19 America isn't really any different than 1997, 1998, 1999, 2000. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions probably in our country today. And I say our, not meaning you, John. But I like taking my digs at you over the Canada thing. You're in there with the Survivor thing being like, what did I do wrong? But I don't want to get political with this, but I think that there's such a feeling in American society that everything has just gotten to a point of no return. Mm-hmm. And it all started because of 2016.
Yeah.
Whether I agree with what happened in 2016 or not, that is Donald Trump being elected to the presidency, America becoming what it is did not start in 2016. It didn't start when Obama became president in 2008. And it didn't start when Bush became president in 2000. I could do this literally for all presidents' terms, probably back to the beginning of American history in 1776. So that's where I come in and say, they're having these dinner table scenes. They're the best parts of the movie. It, hands down, yes. Not even close. The dinner table scenes
absolutely
are the best parts of the movie. The Elliot Gould dinner table scene of Beverly Angelo and Edward Norton and the sister and Edward Furlong and the girlfriend is the best scene of this movie. Because it is a conversation that if you go to Thanksgiving dinner with your racist uncle or whatever they want to say, you could very well end up in this exact same conversation. This is the same conversation that's happening. And I think that that, to me, is what I liked most about this movie, is mm-hmm. that for the people who love this movie, just remember, this was made in 1998. They couldn't have been talking about this stuff if it didn't all start until 2016. I just think that that is the interesting thing. No, it was around forever. The Rodney King conversation is crazy, but it's brilliantly written. And not for nothing, Derek Vineyard very much believes what he is saying, which makes this scene compelling. It's not like Derek Vineyard is an idiot. They tell you Derek Vineyard's incredibly smart. They tell you that at one point he was very much into different kinds of literature because of his teacher. And they show you what his father does to him and how he convinces him, how his father is killed and how that could corrupt, and where he goes while he's looking for his rebound.
Yeah.
All of this stuff is happening in 1998. That's when this movie is made.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I just think that it is. That's where it really excels. Now, granted, a lot of that is reading into what's going on behind the scenes and looking at it with 24 years of perspective now. So that's why I don't necessarily give it all the credit for having that. It is very, as fucked up as this sounds, it is very lucky that America hasn't changed all that much.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And I think that's the really interesting thing about, like, the title being American History X. You can look at it like, you know, a Malcolm X reference or whatever you want to look at it. I kind of look at it as X being a cross-section of American history. And that's what I really think American History X is working towards, is it's not telling you this is the way America is now. It's telling you this is the way America has always been, and there are just a lot of people who are willing to ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And again, like, how does somebody like Derek Vineyard become the way he is? How does he become a racist? We see his progression. We see that it has to do with his upbringing, but that it also has a lot to do with what happened to his father. And why he would start to feel that way, because that's what his father taught him. And now he needs to give his anger to someone. It just so happened the people who that his father died because of were Black. And that's going to change his perspective on things. And so, but then it also shows what happens when you come out of jail. I mean, the perspective of the jail scenes of he's going straight over to his Aryan Brotherhood and they betray him more than anybody else, because he doesn't believe they stand for anything. So he decides to take a stand for them and they just abuse him like anybody. And who does he befriend? He befriends the Black guy. Yeah. That's where it's showing you all of these things. And that's why it starts to peel back these layers on Derek Vineyard. I don't know if a character like Derek Vineyard would succeed anymore. Think about it with Sam Rockwell and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Everybody hates that character. There was a lot of backlash when he won the Oscar for that movie.
Yeah.
But he's going through the same arc as Derek Vineyard.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like the redemption of Derek Vineyard more because it's the extreme. I think I wrote this when I watched Don't Look Up last week, I said the problem with Don't Look Up is that it's trying to make satire out of just what's happening today rather than focusing on the extremes of satire. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think the Derek Vineyard character does. Because Derek Vineyard is a literal neo-Nazi with a swastika tattooed on his chest, he seems like an on his heart, he seems like an extreme. And people are more comfortable when they watch an extreme transition into a redemption arc than when they watch someone who is casually racist transition into a redemption arc.
Yeah, I hear that. And that's weird, right? Because shouldn't the casually racist one who then redeems himself, they probably were less dangerous the entire time than the extreme one who redeems themselves. But that, unfortunately, is kind of where America goes. It's always extremes. And that's one of the biggest problems with our country in general right now. If you don't, and I don't know what it's like in Canada right now. I'm going to be honest. I just know that there's truckers doing a whole lot of shit.
Things are pretty extreme here right now.
Things are pretty extreme. It doesn't really matter where you are. But it's funny how it's the whole pro-life, pro-choice thing. If you're if you're pro-life, well, then you believe everything is up. But if you're pro-choice, that means you believe that you want to murder a baby. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it with masks now. If you don't wear a mask, it's because you want people to die. You're that selfish that you want these people to die. If you do wear a mask, well, it's because you're a crazy person who is just corrupted by the mainstream media.
Yep.
These extremes are the only way we know how to act. But that's why sports teams, that's why you pick this one and root really hard against the other, because it's the extreme. Nobody's going to sit down and watch, I don't know, the Jets play the Giants if there's not a conflict going on between Jets and Giants fans.
Yeah.
That's why when the Texans play the Jaguars, nobody watches it because nobody cares about either of those teams. And so that's the thing here. It's showing this extremism. And how the brother gets caught up in the extremism. He doesn't know where else to go because where else would he go? His brother, his father dies, his brother goes to jail, and it's according to him. And I keep saying all this, but according to it's because of these two black men.
Yep.
That's probably going to cause racism inside of him because nobody's telling him not to be racist except for his sister, who they don't respect anyway. So look at how this is going, but it's leading to those extremes. And what are they trying to do to the sister who's really not extreme? They're trying to make her seem like, oh, she's just a bleeding heart.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I mean, there's definitely like misogyny in this film as well, very evidently.
Oh, is there? I didn't notice.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, it was very subtle.
But I think that's the big thing. And that's why Danny's character is so interesting, is because he's that bright-eyed kid who's just looking up to his big brother. And like, he sees no wrong in his brother. And when Derek goes away to jail, he still ends up following his brother's path, despite the fact that if Derek had stayed, it could potentially have been worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like about the commentary in American History X, is that the black and white sequences seem like flashbacks. They are Danny writing his paper.
Yep.
Yeah. And
after being told by his brother what happened, this is still his take on what he's being told.
Yeah. And it's... I love the fact that it's kind of contrasting that black and white sequence with the color sequences, where, especially because the black and white sequences are all these more extreme sequences too,
mm-hmm.
where things are kind of portrayed black and white, where it's like, it's us versus them the entire time. And I think that's kind of the brilliance of the filmmaking in this movie, where yes, some of the performances aren't great.
I think Edward Furlong is a terrible actor.
I mean, that's why Edward Furlong didn't do much after this movie. But
good point.
And I also think that the performances seem very bad in comparison to how good Edward Norton's performance is.
That also does not really help. You know, that's not really through any fault of anybody else. That's just the fact that, Edward Norton is really, really good.
Edward Norton's always been good, but this performance is absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
And he brings this terror to Derek Vineyard when he's in like the extremist mode. But when he's post-prison Derek, he brings this like gentle remorse to the character as well. And it's so impressive seeing the different, like, again, the different extremes of this character portrayed by Edward Norton.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like you start to feel bad for him. because you can tell that whatever happened to him and Jeff, and see, this is one of the more interesting looks at this. And I think we had a movie not too long ago that was similar, Clockwork Orange. But this is similar to that, where it's, he goes to jail. He is clearly remorseful for what he's done. He wants to change. He's doing everything he can to change, blah, blah, blah. But will the world forgive him? He's even working with that teacher that he had to try to save his brother and to try to take down all of the other neo-Nazis. So what is he going to, but would he be forgiven? And I think that's what's interesting now. Imagine if this was made during social media times. Oh no, he's out. What are we going to say about this person? Is there a way to redeem yourself, or once you do one thing wrong, are you completely done? And I'm not saying that's the same thing here, but that's what this movie is trying to say. What can we forget? Yes. We almost are to Magnolia. And that is the line from Magnolia. That is the line that just drives home that movie for me. What can we forgive? Because that is the big question about human nature. What are we willing to forgive and what are we not willing to forgive?
Yep.
This movie, we see this man. He is racist. He has a swastika over his heart. He goes to jail for killing two black men who were robbing from him. So where do you stand on that? That's all also making it complex. He didn't hunt these guys down.
Nope.
Did he go overboard? Oh, yeah. But he didn't hunt these guys down. So now that makes it complex. And now he's out on a manslaughter charge, and he's trying to protect his brother and his family. No longer a skinhead, none of that. What do we forgive about this guy? Does he deserve forgiveness? And if he doesn't deserve forgiveness, what is the point of the prison system? So that's where this movie is insanely interesting. And I think, what does it for me with this movie? I think the concept of this movie is great, but I always go back to Clockwork Orange as that's what this genre should be. And so for me with this movie, I don't like the performances aside from Edward Norton. Elliot Gould's okay. But I think really everybody else is kind of like, hello, I'm acting. How are you? Especially Ethan Suplee is, in my opinion, horrible.
Oh, he's terrible in this movie.
Ethan Suplee, they are literally like, hey, let's make him the most over the top version of this. And it just goes to corny. I don't necessarily think Tony K's direction is very good. And I think that the screenplay starts to become very preachy at points. But the way it makes you think afterwards is ultimately what elevates this movie and what keeps it from being, in my opinion, a bad movie, and probably what keeps it in your top 50, as we're seeing here, because it does have those moments of just absolute brilliance. And it will make you think about, man, what am I doing, for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah, that's really what this movie comes down to for me, is that it's just designed in a way to make you think. Like you said, it makes you think about the prison system and reformation, whether or not it's something that can happen. And I love how it's designed narratively to make you feel incredibly uncomfortable. The basketball scene is one of the most uncomfortable scenes in this movie, outside of the curb stomping scene. Because you're like, oh, are we supposed to cheer for them being, like, winning this game
though? It takes the sport thing. Now we're rooting for, are we rooting for the white people or the black people to kick the other race off of the court forever?
Yeah, it's brilliant how it approaches these discussions. And it's so beautiful, the nature versus nurture aspect of it, where, I mean, it hints at it a lot, saying that, like, Derek fell in with Cameron, and, like, that's how he got to his extremism. And then when it hits you with that gut punch of that breakfast conversation with his dad, as he's like, okay, well, now I'm reading, I can't remember what book they were reading, but they're reading this book. It's about race relations and everything. And then it just goes to the point where we see that his dad is very racist, not to the same extreme that Derek is racist.
Yeah.
But we see that this is the nurturing that Derek has had growing up. So it's not a surprise that he went to this extreme.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Like, that's where it starts, though. It starts with the subtle. It starts with the casual. This dad, at the end of the day, he's just saying to his son, he thinks he's giving his son good advice. He's not telling his son to go out and kill black people.
No.
Which is what Derek Vineyard ends up doing. There's a difference there, but it starts somewhere. And that's where it starts in this movie. And I mean, the downfall of Derek Vineyard is an incredible, but I like watching the rise and the fall. And spoilers. I love that it's the brother who gets killed at the end, because the brother following in his footsteps and finally realizing how wrong everything he's doing is. Well, here you go.
That is what makes this ending so impactful, is the fact that we've gotten the redemption. Derek's had his redemption. He's come out of prison. He's showing his redemption. And he's finally gotten to the point where Danny's also being redeemed. Danny's seen the light. He knows that he shouldn't be doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. And then Danny gets gunned down in the school bathroom.
Yep.
And at that
point, by somebody that he now regrets talking to the way that he did.
Yeah. And it's so poignant that, like, Derek comes in, cries over Danny's body. And you just have to be thinking about what's going through Derek's head there. It's like, mm-hmm. Derek finally got to the point. He got through to his brother. And now he doesn't even know if he's redeemed himself, because all of a sudden his brother's dead.
Yep. Yep. And that's the thing. And then the paper is just sitting right there. And you know that it's going to be read. But it's getting into that whole thing of the hate, and there is no good person in this. And that's what I really like about it, is they're not trying to tell you, oh, the white people are good or the black people are good. They're just telling you this is bad. Hate is whatever the last line is with the hate, where again, it's like, oh, this is preachy. But whatever the last line is about hate, that's what the ultimate message of this movie is. Yeah. And that's what you need to take away from this movie. That's the important part of this movie. Again, I think it's the highest or second highest rated movie from 1998 on like IMDb and like in general. I know Life is Beautiful.
8.4 on
8.5 on IMDb. Yeah. I know Life is Beautiful was 1998 as well. Saving Private Ryan. So those are kind of the three. Do I think that this one is up there with like the movies that I like the most from that year? No, I don't. Like Shakespeare in Love, The Thin Red Line, I'd put those up there way higher than this one. But there's more to this movie than I think even a lot of people realize. Like Shakespeare in Love, where people don't give it the credit, I think sometimes people give American History X credit for the wrong things.
Yeah.
American History X isn't some really edgy movie. No. I don't even find it to be all that profound for most of it. But it is very much looking at a very real portion of America. Mm-hmm. And a distinct portion of this country that thinks a certain way. But also, it's not doing it with kid gloves, where it's, oh, he is horrible and everybody else around him is so perfect and he just can't see it. Everybody in this movie is bad. From the mother to the brother to, you know, everybody at the school, they're all bad. That's it. There's really no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I guess Elliot Gould's not necessarily bad. But it's not telling you to root for anybody. And I think that's what you need when you have an anti-hero like Derek Vineyard, because if you didn't, if you're being told to root for anybody, then it's kind of like, well, what's the point of this movie?
Yeah, exactly. I will say this. There is one scene in this movie that's totally pointless and should not be in this movie. Should have been cut on the editing room floor. The scene where the principal goes to the police station and they just talk about neo-Nazis.
I hated that part so much. That was when I was like, is this movie bad? I hated that scene so much.
It's so pointless. It has no relevance to anything else happening in the entire book. It's just like an exposition dump. It doesn't make sense why it's there.
Yep. I agree. It's literally just to be like, oh, let's tell you about Cameron Alexander and let's tell you neo-Nazis are bad. We don't need that scene at all. I couldn't agree more. We just do not need it.
Because it turns out Nazis are bad, and we know that.
Yeah, it's not shocking. Nobody's sitting there going, what?
Especially in 1998, when there are three Best Picture noms about Nazis being bad.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I agree. It's frustrating. That's really all it comes down to. It's just frustrating with that. So, I don't know, John.
But overall, I really enjoy I really like movies that make you think. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a trend we see for the next 47 films we talk about on my list. I love movies that are making you think about yourself, look introspectively, looking at society and what it's doing. And that's where American History X really hits me, is I feel like a good movie, an excellent movie, is one where you are contemplating everything it's trying to demonstrate hours, days, weeks after you watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And this is definitely a movie you'll think about. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. You'll probably think about this one more than Shakespeare in Love, even though I think Shakespeare in Love is better by a lot.
Unless you're a Shakespeare nerd, because then you'll think about Shakespeare in Love a lot. Yes, then you won't stop thinking
about Shakespeare in Love. That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, American History X is a heavy watch. It's a hard watch. It's a heavy watch. It's meant to make you uncomfortable. Tony Kaye really didn't do much after that. The director of this movie, he did Detachment, which is actually a very good movie. I've actually seen Detachment. I didn't realize he did that. The Adrian Brody movie. That's a very good movie. But he didn't really do much. Mm-hmm. He just didn't. He has a very distinct style, though. I didn't realize he did the Runaway Train by Soul Asylum music video, which is actually a great music video. Very 90s, that's for sure. But yeah, like, this movie was a hit. It has definitely gained notoriety and credit over time, kind of like Life is Beautiful. I know Life is Beautiful had the Oscar noms and the Oscar wins and all that. But even Life is Beautiful at the time, it was a big hit with fans, wasn't so much a big hit with critics, even though it was winning Oscars. And then as time moved away from it, it actually started to get more and more popularized. Like, there's like this Absence Makes the Heart Grow Fonder about it. Yep. And, you know, do I necessarily think either one of them is as good as they get the credit for? No. But I do think both of them definitely do a good job at looking at, you know, Nazis and, you know, different eras of dealing with that and different people who have to deal with it. So, yeah, I mean, American History X is worth a watch. If you haven't seen it, see it. It's worth it. And if you haven't seen Shakespeare in Love, actually watch it and give it a friggin' chance. That's the message of this week, right? Love, yeah, don't hate. Don't hate Shakespeare in Love just because of what it is. Love it until you have a reason to hate it. And then even love it because hate is bad, or something that Edward Furlong says. John, anything else about American History X?
Nope.
Cool. Next week, we are going to our number 47. And John's going to be talking about Super from 2010, which my library did not have. So now I'm going to have to pay for it. Thanks, John. And Alien from 1979, which my library did have. So I'm very excited about that. Super 2010 with Rainn Wilson. Alien 1979 doesn't really need an introduction. Very excited to talk about both of these movies. I haven't seen Super in a very long time. And I remember being like, damn, this is a weird movie. James Gunn, right?
Yeah, that is. It's a weird movie. It's definitely a weird movie.
I remember it was quite the rage, though, when it came out, because people were so confused by what the hell they were watching. But that'll be next week. Become a patron. Listen to us talk about Licorice Pizza. And tonight we're going to be talking about Power of the Dog. So that'll be thrown up there, too. And we'll be going through all 10 of the Best Picture nominees as we work our way up to Oscar Sunday, which is about 6 weeks away somehow. So whatever. Enjoy. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast. Also, if you're a Survivor fan, Alexa and I are going to be talking about, we're going to be doing our boot list in 45 minutes. So enjoy that as well. Busy night for me. We'll see everybody next week.